Welcome to the Inner Side Radio Program. My name is Scooter. I'll be your host for the next 30 minutes, and we'll be hearing from Daryl Ray, who's going to talk about his new book, The God Virus. And I'll be reading off some related websites at the end of the program if you want to learn more. And we are talking to Daryl Ray. Welcome to the program.
Well, thanks for having me on, Scooter.
Well, you betcha. So the God Virus gets a little rough. Would you describe yourself as an anti-theist? I can't figure out whether I'm an agnostic or not. I have no knowledge of that.
Well, I don't wear labels very well. I know I'm an atheist, but I'm not sure I'm anti-theist. Big reason I wrote the God Virus in the very introduction is I want to educate people as to what they're really engaging in when they engage in religious behavior and how that got into their brains in the first place. I'm a psychologist by training, so I want people to understand what's going on in their mind when they're dealing with religion.
And a lot of the books that have come out recently don't really, well, other than Daniel Dennett, don't really take the psychological approach.
And that's a big part of why I wrote it. I'd read everything, going clear back to Ingersoll and Bertrand Russell. And nobody had said, look, let's understand this from a psychological perspective. And that's what motivated me. Dennett, as good as Dennett's book is, it still didn't tell you. At the end, doesn't say, how do you change your behavior or how do you modify your behavior in this religious world? And that was my goal in the book, as you know, in the last four chapters, to say, okay, here's some things you can do in the real world. And nobody else did that. I still to this day don't know of a book that talks about those kinds of behavioral things.
Can you give us a little background on your own religious upbringing? Or do you think that's relevant to the...
Well, probably is. I was raised in a very fundamentalist and very loving family. They did the best they could with the tools they had. They were raised in a very fundamentalist environment themselves. I was pretty taken with religion and never quite bought the whole party line, but I really enjoy helping people. I'm an executive coach, so that says a lot right there. I love coaching people. I thought I was going to go into ministry, so I got my bachelor's degree in sociology and anthropology. Raised a lot of questions. I actually believed in evolution. It's just a no-brainer, actually. But I also believe strongly in religion. So I went ahead and got my master's degree at Skerritt College for Christian Workers in Nashville, Tennessee. And at the end of that two-year program, I realized I couldn't teach or preach what I didn't believe myself. So kind of dropped down, didn't drop out because I had a family and kids and a religious wife and in-laws and parents. So
it was
pretty much painted into a corner till I finally got my kids raised.
So you're well-versed in the subject.
What
part of the country did you grow up in?
Well, I grew up in Wichita, Kansas.
Kansas, okay.
I went off to graduate school in Skerritt, and then when I finished my master's in religion, I went on to get my doctorate in psychology at Vanderbilt. And that, you know, that really cinched the whole thing. Once I figured out the whole psychology stuff, I thought, okay, this makes no sense whatsoever.
Yeah. In order to get a grip on your book, The God Virus, one has to grasp the concept of the meme and how that differs from an analogy or a metaphor. You want to talk about that for a minute?
Yeah. Well, of course, going back to Richard Dawkins' book, The Selfish Gene, he coined the term meme. And there was kind of an entire study came out for some years called Memetics. And I kind of took my lead from where Dawkins was. Think of a meme as a set of instructions, an idea, if you will. And that set of instructions is not unlike a set of instructions in your computer. And, you know, people talk about computer viruses, but the instructions that a computer virus does is parasitic. It tends to destroy or do harm to the computer and then want to go on to get into other computers. It wants to replicate itself. Well, memes are very similar to that. They're a set of instructions that want to replicate themselves. Now, some of these instructions are benign, like the hula hoop. You know, there's a whole group of instructions that would go into the meme we would call hula hoop. You know, there's a whole group of ideas around the hula hoop, but it's pretty benign, and nobody died from hula hooping, probably. then there's memes that are very beneficial instead of some instructions, if you will, and that's the, like algebra. Algebra is a set of instructions, and it really is a very helpful set of instructions, if you will, for living in the real world or calculating real-world issues. So that's a beneficial meme. And then there's parasitic memes. And those are memes that tend to get in your brain and do harm or take over or make you do things you wouldn't normally do. And you can tell the, you can tell these are parasitic because people do unnatural things when these memes get into their head. And you ask the question, well, what could that be? And the simplest simplest example is a Catholic priest. Catholic priests or nuns are celibate. That's pretty damn unnatural behavior. It means they're committing genetic suicide. So being celibate is a pretty unnatural thing. There's really no animal species on the face of the earth that's voluntarily celibate. And humans weren't voluntarily celibate. You know, there's just no reason for it until you get infected with the God virus, some kind of God virus, or a meme, as we call it in Dawkins' sense. And then behavior changes. So parasitic memes have powerful influences over people to do some pretty crazy things, like give 10% of your income to a church that's going to spend it to propagate the meme to everybody it can. And so that's pretty strange. Why would you give 10% of everything you earn to somebody that's just going to use it to propagate that same meme into other people's heads?
Right.
Well, it's interesting that the concept of the meme went viral. On the
Yeah, it did.
And
I had always assumed that the meme came from McLuhan, you know, but I think that Dawkins may have been borrowing from him, you know, but I didn't realize until your book that was from Dawkins. I didn't know that.
Yeah, well, Dawkins in that chapter in The Selfish Gene gives credit to a couple other theoreticians, but he is literally the person that coined the term meme.
Got it, right.
And
right.
He even talks about that in one of his books, how he came up with that idea.
Do you use parasitic and viral synonymously, or
the concept of a virus is simply a metaphor? I could call it the God fungus. Parasites, funguses, bacteria, and viruses all have the ability to affect our behavior. So I was just trying to show that there is a remarkable parallel between biological pathogens and mental pathogens, if you will.
Got it.
And a parasitic meme is a mental pathogen. It infects your brain as much as HIV virus infects your body, or the rabies virus infects your central nervous system. So once you understand and look at the parallels between biological pathogens and idea pathogens, then the whole thing just breaks wide open. It just becomes really clear why they work the way they do, and how ideas, parasitic ideas especially, can propagate from one mind to the next.
You talk about rabies specifically as a good model to describe what you're talking about. You want to go into that for a minute?
Well, when you get it, you know, you get bit by something. The virus takes a little while to work up through the nervous system, and in doing that, it hides. Your body doesn't know it's infected with rabies until it gets clear into your brain. And then it takes over your brain and changes your behavior. The virus literally programs you to do unnatural things, like go in harm's way. And if a raccoon has rabies, it may attack a dog that's much bigger than it. A raccoon would normally run as fast as it can to get away from that dog. Whereas with rabies, it says, no, attack that dog, so that it can get from the raccoon to the dog's brain.
And you know, as in the parable of man bites dog, humans don't usually run around biting people, at least not in recorded civilization. But people do tend to bite people when they have rabies. So it's a really, really specific behavior that the rabies virus seems to hone in on, which is to propagate itself.
Religions program people to do very specific things, too. When the Mormons knock on your door, they're trying to sneeze on you. They're trying to give you their virus. When the Jehovah's Witnesses knock on your door, they're trying to sneeze on you. And, you know, a lot of people think, well, I'm a human being. I'm not I'm not controlled by anything. I have my own free will. But if you've had a cold or you've had the flu this year, you got your nervous system taken over. When you sneeze, you didn't sneeze for no good reason. You sneeze because a rhinovirus that infected your sinuses irritates your sinus cavity so that you will sneeze. It takes over your sneeze reflex. So you literally have had your behavior programmed by a virus when you sneeze.
I've noticed that when Mormons knock at my door, they often leave with a cold.
Oh, good.
You also talk about viruses can also be symbiotic with an existing social order. Could you talk about that?
Well, yeah. I mean, not all viruses are going to kill you, and having one virus can prevent you from getting another virus. I mean, I believe it was Edward Jenner in the late 1700s discovered that milkmaids who had gotten cowpox rarely, if ever, got smallpox. He started experimenting. He inoculated some people with the cowpox virus. And lo and behold, they could not get the smallpox virus. So it was the first example of one virus heading off another virus that we know of in medical history. And if you look at that from a religious perspective, if you get infected with the Catholic God virus, it's going to be very difficult for the Baptist virus to infect your brain. It will somewhat inoculate you against other God viruses. And that's, in fact, the way God viruses work. They always inoculate you against other God viruses that would be competing. You can have multiple compatible viruses that are working together inside of you. I mean,
there are people who sort of are pan-religionists, that they could kind of believe in everything. It's all the same message. It's sort of a New Age idea.
Those are pretty benign. You know, those are pretty benign God viruses.
It's spiritualism, I think.
Yeah, they don't generally make people give lots of money or stop having sex. or feel guilty about sex. So
there you go.
It's still a God virus, and it still can affect behavior, but not as parasitic.
So as you mentioned, we're talking religion often degenerates into legalistic interpretations and literalism, and we refer to that as fundamentalism. And at this point, it seems to be the most obvious when the virus develops the antibodies that you were talking about, inoculating the host against competing religions.
And I talk about in the book that fundamentalism is the shock troops of any religion. Anytime a religion feels attacked or under pressure, a certain section of that population will become fundamentalist, and they will then be the army of that religion to attack back and defend the religion.
And you talk about, I guess, the environment in which fundamentalism often arises. It's an unusual form of the religion, am I correct?
If you think about it, every religion starts out fundamentalist. I mean, the founders of almost any religion start out with a pure type of idea. And from that purity, they try to maintain a strict hold on the followers. And it's pretty parasitic and even harmful, but it propagates. That's why you see a lot of people saying, well, we need to go back to our roots. We need to go back the way Jesus taught or the way Muhammad taught. And that's a cry to go back to the fundamentalism of that particular
I think people don't understand how rough some of the early Christianity and what Jesus was talking about meant, because they don't read the Bible, but go ahead.
You know, they don't read their own Bible. Yeah, the New Testament is full of incredibly fundamentalist statements. But you notice that liberals can read that Bible and just selectively leave out all the fundamentalist statements that Paul made, that Jesus made, that Peter makes. I mean, there's tons of misogynistic, anti-women, oppressive statements.
Anti-family.
Anti-family.
Anti-family, you're right. Yeah, cut off your family, Jesus says.
In a very sort of like Scientology, in a way.
You know,
exactly,
right.
And that's the way it worked in the early days of Christianity. But they can just ignore that. And what the God virus does, once it infects your brain, it really helps you to selectively get rid of any contradicting evidence. You literally cannot see it.
Well, back to the concept of fundamentalism, I'm going to read a short phrase from the book. It says, "A society cannot survive for long with rampant fundamentalism. It must be brought back under control once the emergency has passed, or the expansion is complete.
Well, it's absolutely right, and we can see real evidence of it. The Shia rebellion against the Shah of Iran when the Ayatollah Khomeini came in. But shortly after that, it became very dangerous. I mean, you can't let these crazies run rampant for too long, or they run out of people to kill and run out of people to put in jail.
Run out of Baha'is.
Yeah, they run out of Baha'is, literally, or Sunnis. And so when they run out of those, they have to start turning on themselves. I mean, the purity of fundamentalism dictates that I'm more pure than you. And since I'm more pure than you, you're the one that gets to go to jail, especially if I have the political power. And that was what was going on in Iran. So it took about 10 years after that to get the fundamentalism under control. In the United States, we see fundamentalism arising in the 1950s in response to communism.
Just what you just touched on is what you're calling the American civil religious infection, which is particularly acute presently. I mean, I would say worse now than the 50s, wouldn't you?
Well, I don't know how old you are, but I saw it in the 50s, and it was pretty bad.
Okay.
It was pretty bad. McCarthyism was rampant, and a lot of people got hurt.
But McCarthy didn't talk about Jesus a lot, did he? I mean, wasn't that more of a rise of a sort of a form of nationalism than?
Well, see, I think it's Christianism, and Christianism is Christianity cloaked in nationalism, or vice versa. All you have to do is talk to my grandmother. She's been gone a few years now, but in the 50s, Jesus and America were the same as far as she was concerned.
Mm-hmm.
Billy Graham was right at the head of it. Billy Graham instituted the National Day of Prayer, I believe it was 1952 or 53, and his successors are still out there. So this Christianist political movement started back then. Now, took years to get it going. You got the Jerry Falwells and the Pat Robertsons that put more structure around it, but it was there. And McCarthyism, while it wasn't overtly religious, God and country were very important, and it was in that order, God and country.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't say country and God.
I didn't think that McCarthy and Nixon and those guys were particularly... I don't remember them using that a lot, although they played a heck of a lot of lip service, especially to Graham.
Oh, absolutely. Graham was in there having prayers with all the presidents up until, what was it? I don't think he prayed with Bill Clinton.
I'm sure if he was still alive, we'd have heard him instead of that other jerk.
Still alive. Graham is still alive.
He is?
He turned over his organization to Franklin Graham, but yeah, he's still alive and making pronouncements every now and then from North Carolina area, Nashville.
I guess God wants nothing to do with him. He doesn't want him around.
But we're seeing a rise in it, really. It's kind of hilarious, actually. Look at Christine O'Donnell. I mean, that is the most amazing example of somebody who's thoroughly infected with a God virus. And all the crazy behavior that she exhibits, including... not masturbating and no sex before or outside of marriage. And, well, you know, I don't know if you've been following her.
Oh, yeah. I consider her to still be 14. Yeah. That's all I can get from her. Yeah.
She is. And, you know, that's subject for another day is the whole sex thing. We can come back and talk about that.
But she rose to fame by being a kook. She was created by Bill Maher. If he hadn't had her on that show 22 times, nobody would know who she was.
Yeah, I can't figure out why she was on there.
Well, because he just wanted somebody to point and laugh at. And he likes pretty girls.
He got that. He also created a monster.
Exactly, unintentionally. But that's how it goes, doesn't it? That's how it goes. So, we as non-believers understand morality to be situational.
Yeah.
And unless you're Sam Harris. Whereas religious morality pretends to be absolute, while it is perhaps even more situational and agenda-driven than we the godless share.
Well, if people had a long-term view of their own religion, they would see dramatic differences in morality even. Some people may remember that no Catholic woman would be allowed in church without a hat on. Paul said a woman should not be in church without a hat on. And then if you look at the concept of, say, murder, and when I read the Ten Commandments, and it says, thou shalt not kill, I just can't find any way around that. But if you look at the history of what was considered murder and what wasn't with respect to religion, The Catholics didn't think it was murder to torture people to death during the Inquisition. And the Protestants in Massachusetts didn't think it was murder to hang Quakers when they came in and messed with their puritanical religion. It's not murder if I'm killing you in defense of my religion. Where can soldiers murder? Is it possible for a soldier to be a murderer? And I think it clearly is.
We have actually in civil society that loophole as well. So, I mean, not only does religion have caveats for that, but so does nationalism. And I would have to say that the entire Old Testament is 3,000 pages of caveats to thou shalt not kill.
Yeah. Yeah. The Israelites who came up with these Ten Commandments didn't seem to mind, and neither did their God mind when they killed all the men, women, and children, including pregnant women, when they, you know, take over a city. God, the God that sent Noah down here to
kill everybody.
Kill everybody.
He just killed everybody, the whole planet.
Yeah, it's just incredibly situational. And it's situational with respect to where that religion wants to go and how it's going to propagate. So you can see that religions are always changing their morality. For example, the Catholic Church is dead set against divorce. But 70%+ of all annulments given in the entire world are given to the 3% of the Catholics that live in the United States. So that tells us the Catholic Church, that's totally against divorce, is giving a heck of a lot of annulments, which equal divorce, in the United States. Why are they doing that? Because, you know, if they just excommunicated everybody that got divorced, they'd have no members and no money. So it's a survival strategy for the Catholic God virus. Don't excommunicate people who are...
Or develop a workaround, which they are famous
that's
for.
That's what they've done. They've developed a workaround.
They're famous for that.
It's very effective. The Catholics, you're right, Catholics are famous for that. Catholics have a very fluid morality.
So we're back to situational. And I think you pointed out in the book that not only morality sort of creep from generation to generation and society to society, but it does so within the church. In other words, it's usually the priest or the minister or sort of have a yardstick of morality, and depending on what he's talking about, it kind of just shifts around. He's constantly redefining, in other words.
Exactly. The yardstick is always moving, and it's a response to the culture. Because religion and culture are two different issues, two different things. And religion wants to dominate culture. But in a secular culture like ours, it's very difficult for religion to do that. So religion has to change its yardstick to keep up. You know, the yardstick of don't wear hats in church, don't wear pants in church, don't get divorced. What's murder and what's not murder? All those things change. And sometimes within just the framework of a single generation, it can change.
Well, I must be a fundamentalist because I never wear a hat in church.
No, the women have to wear hats, not men.
Oh, okay. Well, I don't wear a hat in church anyway, you know, because I'm a feminist.
Okay, there you go.
Well, before I let you go, by the way, we're going to come back next week and we're going to talk about sexual control by religious, which is obviously the fattest and juiciest subject.
Oh, so, yeah, it's great subject.
Right, right.
And there's a lot to say about that.
Yeah. Well, I know you're out of Dallas. You're out of Houston, right?
Yes.
Well, I just want to put a little plug in. I'll be speaking in Dallas this weekend. Anybody's going to be up to the Freethinkers Convention, the Texas Freethought Convention. Make sure your listeners know about our Recovering from Religion. You know, if you're a person recovering from religion, take a look at our website, recoveringreligionist.com, and see what we've got to offer there.
I did want to touch on this just briefly because, I mean, I just read this the other day, and I was shocked. Although I can't believe I'm still shocked by things, but there you go. The Catholics are getting a lot of press. Well, they get the most press for sexually abusing young boys, but actually it turns out they're sexually abusing young women as well. It just doesn't get as much press.
Right.
But you talk about the Baptist, and you put a website on here. Could you know that website?
BaptistPredators.org.
Say it again?
BaptistPredators.org.
But I went there and I looked at it, and you know, I saw on the front page what they have is a list of mainstream newspaper articles about these ministers being busted for all sorts of stuff. And I said, well, you know, that's kind of typical for a web page. They're going to have these mainstream articles on here. And yeah. And then I looked at the dates, and they were all from last week.
Yeah.
They were all from last week. I went, holy crap. That was a real shock. So.
And we only see the tip of the iceberg. When I was growing up, as I talk about in the book, I saw 8 different ministers have inappropriate relationships with women in their church over a 10-year time period. And not one of those ministers got fired the first time they were caught. One of them got to fight with it 3 times. Look at this right. guy in Atlanta, Georgia, you know, that mega church minister yeah. that got caught
with boys
screwing young men, 4 of them. Years ago in my early career, I was in the juvenile justice system.
Well, on which end?
Well, they finally let me out.
So we have something in common.
I was a psychologist in the, okay. in the Tennessee and the Kansas Juvenile Justice.
Maybe you advised me at some point. Maybe we already know each
oh,
other.
Oh, no. Maybe I might have. But one thing, it was really clear. It, once you caught a kid, he'd already done it 15 times.
Adults as well.
Yeah, just felt the same thing. So I just have no patience for these ministers who get caught and say, I'm sorry, I only did it once.
It is pretty well understood in a lot of these charismatic churches that these ministers are getting a lot of action. I mean, it's kind of well known, even within the church, and that the women, you know, they're going for it. And I see that as being a little bit different than someone who's coming in, who's injured from a divorce or a young person, someone who's vulnerable being taken advantage of by the preacher, as compared to somebody who's just basically, you know, using it as a nightclub.
Right.
I see it as being a little different, but the hypocrisy, nevertheless, is still there, which leads to irony, which leads to comedy, and
makes me laugh.
That's true.
Okay. Well, thanks for your time, and we'll be talking to you. We'll be on again next week. We're going to talk okay. about sex. All right.
Look forward to it.
Okay, Daryl.
All right. Bye.
Check you later.
And here are some relevant websites. You can find out more about Daryl Ray's book, The God Virus, at thegodvirus.net. All you Catholics will want this one. You can say, we're not so bad. StopBaptistPredators.com. StopBaptistPredators.com. And here's a very important website if you're recovering from a God virus and you're looking for people to talk with. Check out RecoveringReligionists.com. That's RecoveringReligionists.com. Religionists is plurals. That's it for the show. We'll be talking to Daryl again next week if the creek is willing and the good Lord don't rise. You've been listening to The Inner Side. My name is Scooter, and I'll see you all then.
Now, understand what I'm saying. If the date's not, you say, well, there it is, 2,000 years ago, that those poor ignorant Thessalonians thought he was coming then, and he hasn't come yet. And where is the promise of his coming, Peter said they would say. The idea is not that